Hi, and welcome to the 100th episode of Me and My 88 Friends. My name is Mike Dalka, and I'm your guest host tonight. I'm very honored that Lawrence has allowed me to produce the 100th show. We're going to talk to Lawrence in a little bit, and we're also going to review some of the highlights of the past 100 episodes. So thanks for joining us for this important milestone, and it seemed only appropriate that we start this show where the whole thing started. Episode 1. So let's listen to a little excerpt where Lawrence talks about the meaning of the title of the show and the song that he wrote for it.
The name of this show is called Me and My 88 Friends, and it's a reference to the piano. I am a piano player, a songwriter, a singer, if you want to call it that, let's say a communicator, and a preacher. And so I've had this great love affair with the piano my whole life. In fact, I can't remember a time when I didn't know how to climb up on a stool and pick out a song or a tune with one finger. So when I was asked to do this program, I thought that's what I want to name it, Me and My 88 Friends. This is an hour of music, mainly of songs that I've written over the years, and of stories, and of celebrating the joy of being a Jesus follower. And so I'm glad that you're joining with me. This is coming from Florence, South Carolina, but the radio station is out of Indiana, where I lived for a number of years. So let's just talk a minute about the show and about the piano, the 88 Friends. There's 88 keys. The piano is an amazing instrument. They called it the pianoforte, which meant soft, loud, or soft, strong. But who wants to write that long word out, pianoforte? So they shortened it up to piano. What it meant was, this is an instrument where you can play softly or loudly. The other keyboard instruments, like the harpsichord, had the same volume. So pianoforte has been my friend for many years. I've played some of the most awful pianos in America. The worst was in the Vermont State Prison. You can imagine what quality they had there in a prison. But I used to be at the mercy of everybody's piano anywhere I sang. I didn't have an electronic piano. I remember one time we were singing in Indiana at a storefront, a coffee house, and we were waiting on the piano to arrive. Well, it arrived all right, but it arrived in really bad shape. I guess somebody put it on the back of a pickup truck, and as they turned the corner, the entire piano smashed into the highway. And so I have to try to play a piano that is now totally out of tune. There was another place in Massachusetts where we drove up, and we started laughing at the piano hammers were sitting on the sidewalk in the pouring rain, in an absolute downpour of rain. And we said, who in the world would do that? Then we walk in and they say, that's the piano that you've got to play tonight. So even though I've played some bad ones, I've played some nice ones too, and I still love that instrument. When I was 20 years old, I was visiting my parents in South Carolina, where I grew up, where I live now again. I had been going to college in Anderson, Indiana, Anderson College at the time. It's now Anderson University. And I was riding in my car and praying, talking to the Lord, which is what prayer is, and just beginning to tell the Lord how much I wish I could write songs, but I couldn't do it. I couldn't come up with original tunes. And I remember saying to the Lord, if you would just give me the gift of writing songs, I want to give you my promise that for the rest of my life, they will all be about you in some way. This was something I could not do. I had tried and tried. You know, after that prayer, within a week, I had my first original tune, and I've been writing. That was in 1969, by the way, so you can kind of tell how old I am when I tell you I was 20 years old at the time. And since that day, I've written probably several hundred songs, some definitely worse or better than others. But I've tried to be true to my promise that I gave him, that if he would do this for me, they would always be about him in some way. Now, not all the songs talk about Jesus from the very start. There are many, write about many things. Like, I've got a song about the Boston Red Sox. I've got a song about Kalamazoo, Michigan. But sooner or later, they end up pointing toward the Lord. I tell people that all of my songs get saved on the third verse. So I wrote this little song that's now our theme song for this show, which is called Me and My 88 Friends. The song is called Me and My 88 Friends. And I went into a studio of a few weeks ago, and we put it down and put a drum to it. So I want you to hear the whole song now. And by the third verse, it will point to Jesus. So here it is, Me and My 88 Friends, sung by yours truly.
In my sight, some are quiet, some are loud, some stand out in a crowd. Me and my 88, me and my 88 friends. We've been friends for a long, long time, ever since I was old enough to climb up on a piano stool and get to know them one by one. Me and my 88 friends. Me and my 88 friends. Some are black, some are white, they are precious in my sight. Some are high, some are low, re mi fa sol la ti do. Yeah, me and my 88. Me and my 88. My 88, me and my 88 friends. We agreed early on we would play and sing the songs to give the glory to the King of Kings. He's the one who gave the harmony. Oh, come let us adore him. Me and my 88, me and my 88. I love my 88, me and my 88 friends.
Is here with me, and we're kind of switching microphones tonight. I'm going to do the interview, and Lawrence is going to be the interviewee. So, Lawrence, first of all, thank you for the honor of getting to host your 100th episode. Can't believe we've done 100 of these so far, can you?
I can't believe it, and I tell you what, nobody has a radio voice like you, so I can't think of anybody with a silver tongue as much as you. So it's an honor for me to have you interview me.
Well, and as one of the people that's here in the building that we're in today just told me, I have a face for radio. So it's
So do I.
Yeah, that's our good buddy Frank Penna. It's been kind of a hectic day for us here where we're at. This is the annual World Renewal Board meeting that happens here at Brandywine Community Church in Greenfield, Indiana, and that was a good time of praise and prayer as well as reports from the field, from missionaries, but at the same time, it took pretty much a full eight-hour day, and then we had to rush around and get set up for the mission celebration tonight, and Lawrence is going to be performing there. And what the mission celebration is just a time to get together and hear field reports. There's not everything that is said in the board meeting can be released to the general public, because some of what World Renewal does is in countries where Jesus is illegal. And so we can't let what's said in the board meeting necessarily be out for the public, but the mission celebration is for the public. And so we've got that tonight. There'll be a couple hundred people here, we hope, in person plus online. And then Lawrence, like I said, you'll be doing a few songs for us like you did last year at the mission celebration. So we're trying to cram this interview in between a whole bunch of stuff today. So really,
that's right.
Yeah, really appreciate your dedication to your ministries. It's really neat. So I'm going to jump right into it because time is a little bit compressed for us here. So, you know, the way you and I first met was you got together with Gary and Roy Renner, is that right?
Ray Renner.
Out at the World Renewal headquarters to talk about the anniversary of the Asbury Revival. And that's where you and Gary first met, really, I guess, through that. Just tell me, if you would, a little bit about that. I know you've done some episodes about it, but for those that haven't heard it, just bring us up to speed on what the Asbury Revival was and how it affected you.
The Asbury Revival was probably the turning point of my life. Gary Wright was a student at Asbury College in 1970, and on February 3rd, 1970, a spontaneous revival broke out unexpectedly. People started coming to the altar, confessing their sins, giving their life to the Lord. It was totally unplanned, and it was in the middle of a chapel convocation. And on just a hunch, the leader decided to give an altar call. Asbury's a religious college. That auditorium had a long altar. And hundreds of people came forward, and it went on, and it went on for 183 hours around the clock. And it made national news. It was just an incredible revival, a true revival. Well, 19 days later, Gary and a team of kids who experienced that revival came to Anderson, Indiana, where I was going to college at Anderson University, and they shared what happened, and the same thing happened in Anderson. I didn't go on for numerous hours around the clock, but it went on for 50 days, two or three services a day. And Gary came to my dorm room the night before, and we've laughed about this for years. He and the students went knocking door to door at the dorm and telling us there had been a great revival in Asbury, and they wanted to share it the next day. They invited us to the service. Well, in my mind, I thought, revival, every church in the South, I am from South Carolina, every church in the South has a spring revival and a fall revival, which is just a series of preaching meetings. I said, I've seen it. I don't need to come. So I didn't come. I turned him down. I didn't turn him down that night, but I just slept in. I didn't go. And then I heard about it that evening, that an unbelievable service had been held that morning. It started about 10 or 10:30, and it didn't get out till like 2:30. And this was like 9:30 or 10 when this person was telling me. He said, it's going on tonight. It started at 6, and he said, it's still going on. It's 10 o'clock. And so that got my interest. Like, what is this that's bringing all these people to the Lord? And the next day, it was the talk of the campus. There was a story on the Asbury Revival on the front page of the Indianapolis Star. And so I went, and it changed my life. It didn't change my life the first night, because I thought, oh, this is great. This is great. All these people are coming to the Lord. I felt I didn't need to, because I was studying to be a minister at the time. But the second night, which was Tuesday, I was sitting in a balcony, and
The Holy Spirit pretty well nailed me to the wall. The Lord asked me, that still small voice, if I wanted you to go to a foreign country as a missionary, out of the way, out of the ordinary, no, nobody would ever hear about you, but that's what I wanted, would you do it? And I said, no. I was honest, I said, no, because I wanted to be a well-known evangelist. I thought, you know, Billy Graham's gonna die one day, and you know, somebody's gotta fill the shoes. And it was just so gentle, so sweet, I guess you would call it. But it was like he was saying, it's not that I'm asking you to do that, but I want to know, are you willing to do whatever I want? And I said, Lord, I have to say no. And then I felt the Lord was showing me that if I don't have all of you, then you can't have all of me, because I had been praying for months for a deeper walk with the Lord. I felt there was something missing in my life. I was becoming really disillusioned with church. Although I love the Lord, there was something missing. And so that Tuesday night, Gary by that time had gone back to Kentucky. I went forward and I just laid it all out. I said, for the rest of my life, I'll do anything you want. It doesn't matter. I just want to have you. And everything in my life goes back to that pivotal night. And of course, Gary was the instrument that brought that to, with a few other kids, brought that to our city. So I'm forever grateful to Gary Wright for being the instrument that changed my life forever. And of course, we lost contact with each other for 5 decades. And it's been a wonderful several years since we reunited.
Let's go back to where it all began. Me and my friends back in Indiana form a three-piece band, bass, drums, and piano, that's all. We didn't sound half bad, we didn't sound red hot, but we prayed real hard and we practiced a lot. We were singing for Jesus, trying to obey the call. We traveled all around for better or worse in a 1959 Cadillac hearse. The ride was smooth, tires were bald. Going town to town on a wing and a prayer. Didn't make much money, but we didn't care. It was all for Jesus, trying to obey the call. Nixon in the White House, hippies in the streets. Some people called us the Jesus freaks. And I have to admit, we were caught up in it all. Songs got better and her hair grew long, and the Jesus movement kept coming on strong. And all the while we were trying to obey the law. We would ride into town in the afternoon, set up the equipment and get in tune. Then we'd gather in a circle and pray for the fire to fall. Pray to Jesus, help us tonight as we sing these songs with all our might. If we reach one person, Lord, it's worth it all. Many years ago, and they still don't play me on the radio, and the crowds I draw run medium or small.
We just played two songs from Lawrence's album, Kalamazoo or Beyond the Blue. The first one was Trying to Obey the Call, and the second one was If I Didn't Know Jesus. Now let's go back to the interview with Lawrence.
It's interesting that you said everything comes back to that, because a lot of times we look at our lives, I think, as a timeline. It's a line in a lot of people's minds, but I think it's also, in a way, a spoke. There's a circular pattern here. Everything revolved around that moment, and yet it's come back around 50 years later to you and Gary becoming friends again, and you've become a part of World Renewal. You're a big part of World Renewal. You pray with us every Thursday in our prayer meeting, and it's interesting to see how God's using you in that regard too, and what World Renewal has kind of become for me. I told my story on your radio show, and I talked about how World Renewal really helped me when I was very broken, and that kind of leads me into what I wanted to talk about next. Your most famous song might be "The Anchor Holds," and I have heard story after story about what that song has meant to people. Tell me about what that song means to you.
Well, whenever I sing that song, I go back to a dark room when I was at probably the most broken in my life. You know, I've seen people sing it in front of thousands of people, but I always go back to my basement in Marlborough, Massachusetts. I was a burnout pastor at the time. Our church was going through the first stages of a split. We had gone through three miscarriages. That the third one was that year. My dad died that year, and I just felt like everything I put my hand to is going up in smoke, other than my marriage and my kids, you know. Mm-hmm. I had three kids, and we had three miscarriages. And in that, I was given a sabbatical for 6 months because I was in no emotional shape to try to help other people. I was really shaken. Now, I didn't lose my faith, but I must say I was shaken. Mm-hmm. Even though I'd always known that we're not exempt from trouble. But I was just burnt out. I was tired. I was discouraged. And in that dark room, I would go down there during my sabbatical, and I would just play the piano. I would sing sometimes the hymns out of the hymn book. I had written many songs before then, but I would just go there and play and pour my heart out to God. And one day the song "The Anchor Holds," first just the chorus came, but I felt a glimmer of hope that we were going to pull out of this really down, depressing time. And it took about 9 months to write it, because I would just like get one or two words a day. And but that's where I go back to really the source, the room, that time frame, which was very dark. And I'm so happy God's used that broken time. I remember saying to the Lord, I know your word says all things work together for the good of those who are called according to your purpose and love God. But I remember saying to God, I don't see it. I don't see anything good coming out of this. And yet, He gave me the anchor holds during that, and we have gotten letters and emails, testimonies, really from all over the world, of people that identify with that song, and so all the glory goes to God. I was at my most broken. You know, somebody, I did a songwriting a seminar with a songwriter, and I had been invited to come at the last minute. So the people putting it on, they knew of me, and they told this other, well-known songwriter. I'm not well-known. They told the well-known songwriter that they had a guy coming in, and she thought, oh, great, this is just what we need, some slick Nashville guy who's just sitting there putting rhymes together. And, of course, she found out that this was not a slick writer or someone just throwing rhymes together. This was from the brokenness of our life, you know, the broken pieces. I've told people sometimes that sometimes we think faith is being mighty and having all this great faith and power, but I learned through that experience, sometimes faith is just clinging by your fingernails. I mean, you're just clinging. You don't have anything, hardly. But the word says a smoldering wick. he won't put out. Mm-hmm. And that's how I felt. I didn't feel like a great flame. I felt like a smoldering wick. Like, God, if you don't come and help me, I'm just, there's nothing left, you know. And it doesn't make sense now looking back. But when you're depressed and when you're discouraged, things don't make sense. You just have an overwhelming sense of loss. So I had no idea the song would turn out what it did, you know. I thought it was just for me.
That's a good story. I appreciate you sharing that, too, because I know it's sometimes difficult to talk about that, but I think the willingness to share your pain with other people lets them know that they're not alone when they're in pain, and I think that's why a lot of people have such a great reaction, or not such a great reaction, but such a strong reaction to your song. I think a lot of people that I've heard stories of people that lost a child and cling to that song. And what you said about clinging, it reminds me of a story that Gary told about his time at Asbury College. He tells a story better than I will tell it, but he said he was walking through the chapel one day, and there were all these banners that were hung up that had been made by students, and one of them said, "God's power is made perfect in weak people." And Gary didn't realize that that was, I think, the New Living Translation, that was in the Bible. And he said he thought, well, that's really nice. Yeah, that's a really nice sentiment. I really like that. And he said as he got up closer, he could see the scripture reference on it, and I can't remember which one it was, but he said, as I walked up there, I saw the scripture reference and realized, well, that's in the Bible, so maybe there's a chance for me.
Well, it's a translation of the verse, and I don't know where it is either. It's in one of the Corinthians, I think, where it's the old translations say, God's power is made perfect in weakness. I think that's the way it says. And that same banner was, they hung that in Anderson during our revival too.
Well, that's neat.
And it really touched me too.
Been beauty these
his eyes have seen. But it was in the night, through those storms of my life, oh, that's where God proved his love. The ship is battered, the anchor holds, though the sails are torn. I have fallen on my knees as I face the raging sea. The anchor holds in spite of the storm. I have fallen down on my knees. I have faced the raging seas. The anchor holds.
Well, since this is the 100th episode, I want to move to something else. I want to talk just briefly about some of the other people that help you with this show. Buddy Miles did a great number of the shows. I would say that Buddy was probably on board for at least the first 80, 85, 90 shows.
Actually, he just did last week's.
Yeah, and he's still helping. So the show that will have aired just before this one airs was also Buddy's work. And then, is it Brian Hoogenboom? Is that how his last name is?
Hoogenboom.
Yeah, Hoogenboom. Brian Hoogenboom. Okay. Yep. Yeah. Wasn't sure how that was pronounced. He's come alongside you recently to help.
Oh, yeah.
I just wanted to mention the commitment that those two guys have. Your job doesn't pay much. Not that you're not a good employer, but I know the job doesn't pay much. And, I worked with Buddy a lot more. Brian's been great, too. But Buddy was interviewed on your show. People can go to the website. You don't happen to remember which episode that was, do you?
I don't, but I just interviewed Brian 2 weeks ago. And I forget the name, what we named it. Oh, that one was called You May Be God, But. It's a long story, but it's something like Peter said he believed Jesus was the Christ, and then he rebuked him and said, you're wrong. But I forget the number, but it was pretty early on. But those guys are great because I have no technological ability or mechanical ability for that matter. All I'm good is to tell a joke and play the piano and sing. But those guys know how to edit and how to, and you do too. A lot of those guys behind the scenes are so important.
Well, I think it's really a blessing to be able to help with your ministry. You know, I think it's the reason I wanted to bring that up was because you have a great gift and you're out there in front, and yet you always are trying to give credit to people that are behind the scenes too, because, you know, you really don't feel it's all about you.
Yeah.
And I think that's a great attitude, and I think it's one of the reasons God's able to use you. And, you know, there's a couple of things I was trying to kind of bring together here so that maybe there's a listener out there that thinks they don't have anything to offer the Lord. Well, they can look at you and think, man, this guy's got so much to offer. He's written songs that are played on the radio. He's got a podcast. He's got this 50-year history of serving the Lord. And some of the stories that you've told on your podcast about traveling around the country in a hearse and just, you know, you've got all this diverse wealth of experience, and it might seem intimidating to some people to think maybe the Lord could use me too. But, you know, I've known you well enough and talked to you enough that you just really cherish the opportunity to serve. And when you get an opportunity to serve something somewhere or serve someone, well, you're humbled by that, and you feel honored that the Lord has chosen to use you. And
I do feel honored. I sure do.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. For so many years in my life, I fell into that trap of comparing myself to somebody else. And you can always find somebody that's more successful than you are, somebody that's being used of the Lord more than you. And so I was in that trap, like, oh, why can't I have a song go on the radio? And then when you get one on there, oh, well, why can't I have more, you know? And you can just beat yourself up. And I did that for years, and I know other people do it, because I feel like I do so little for the Lord compared with so many. But the one, we had one show on the podcast, and I aired it twice, and I may air it again. It's called She Did What She Could. And it was about the woman who poured the perfume over Jesus' head just a day or two before he died. She was a woman. The women had very few opportunities. But she had that perfume. And so she brought it out and poured it over his head. And the disciples rebuked her. In particular, Judas rebuked her, saying that was a waste. You could have sold that and given to the poor. And Jesus stepped up to the plate and said, leave her alone. She did what she could. And that verse has just gripped me for years, because we got to get our minds off of what we can't do. Mm-hmm. What can we do?
This show is really a group effort. There are various people that assist me in great ways. I would not be able to do this if not for them. I want to thank God for my friend Lonnie Curl, who is a pastor of a church called Lamb's Chapel. He's actually going to be interviewed on this show probably next week. He has graciously allowed us to use his sanctuary for the studio for this show. Julie Carroll helps promote the show. I have a wonderful band of musicians that help me put songs together. Keith Hamrick, Brian Hoogenboom, Russell James, and Jason Dowdy. And I really, really lean on this person I'm going to talk to now, named Buddy Miles. He's actually Carl Miles II. Now, that sounds very sophisticated until I tell you his hometown. Buddy, can you tell me your hometown's name?
Gladly, Lawrence. Matter of fact, my hometown was once featured on Hometown Salutes on Hee Haw.
Wow, hee-haw.
Salute!
Tell them the name.
The small town of Hogeye, South Carolina.
Hogeye, that's H-O-G, Hogeye. We don't really come from hugely metropolitan and cosmopolitan areas. Hogeye, South Carolina. Buddy is a generation...
I guess X.
X.
Yeah.
I'm older than his father. And I didn't know till recently, Buddy, because my grandson informed me that some of the other generations laugh at baby boomers. We always grew up thinking we were the coolest generation of all, and these people laugh at us. But Buddy is the same age as my daughter, but he doesn't treat me with the respect that my daughter does, believe me. I ask God to give me humility. He said, I'm going to send you the source that will keep you humble from here on out. His name is Buddy. But let me say this about Mr. Miles here. He's going to turn 40 years old.
April 17th.
In April.
Yeah.
But when I think of Buddy Miles, I think of the following things. First of all, I think of, is it fair to say comical? Zany to the point of ridiculousness sometime. In fact, I thought long and hard before we decided to do this interview because we laugh all the time. But he's also a praise leader and a musician. He's on staff here at the church here in Florence. He is an outdoorsman. I've never seen anybody love a boat or a kayak or a snake more than him. He's also a great father, great husband, and something that's very dear to my heart. He is a foster father. I haven't talked about this a whole lot on the show, but for 20-something years, I also worked as an adoption worker and a foster care worker. So welcome to the show, buddy.
Thank you, Lawrence.
I've seen you really pour your life into your kids, and it's just been a wonderful thing to watch. So any tips you have for any fathers out there, any brand new fathers? What have you learned? How have you learned to prioritize your life to include your kids? Because I know you include them in all sorts of things.
Well, that's an easy thing to answer. My dad, he always told me, I remember him making a statement to me growing up about how, you know, he could have had a job making X amount of money or whatever, but he always wanted to be available to us and a part of our lives. And that, when I became a father, just really became important to me. You know, I had a job, I was a banker, and I was on this career path, and then I had kids, and that became my focus. And so, you know, I try, you know, every day when I come home from work, first thing I do is I locate all of my children and say, hey, give them a hug. I mean, they're my world, you know, to me, it's just natural. Like, I don't have a problem. I look forward to it. You know, my youngest son stays under me all the time when I'm home, want me to play with him, and, like, you know, I just eat it up. So.
I read a thing one time, buddy, where the president, the second president of the United States, John Adams, he kept a diary. And, of course, John Quincy Adams, who became the sixth president, was his son. And his son kept a diary, even when he was a little boy. And John Adams wrote in his diary, this is on the same day now, John Adams wrote, not a very productive day, spent time with John, with Johnny. John Quincy Adams wrote, this was the most wonderful day of my life. Dad and I spent time together. And it's such a different perspective. And I know I was grown up. See, I'm in a different generation than you. That's why I wish you would respect me a little bit more. This man holds my feet to the fire all the time. We'll talk about that in a minute. But my parents' generation, grandparents' generation, this was the philosophy. It was the husband's job to make the money. This was before a lot of women entered the workplace. So if a husband provided the money for the family, he pretty much was off the hook with everything else. It was the wife's job to raise the children, to spend time with them, to teach them about life and all of that. And that really did change. I think need to give credit where credit is due. I think people like James Dobson were some of the first to start really dealing with the issue of how to be a good father and began to expand men's views of what it means to impart things to your children. So let's talk about your parents, your upbringing, buddy. Because I want to talk about how you came to the Lord. You came to the Lord as...
I was about 15 years old.
15? Yeah. I thought you came when you were like 5 years old.
No. Now, when I was five, because I did grow up in church, my grandmother used to love to tell stories about how I would get her little paperback Jimmy Swaggart Bible. She babysat me and a bunch of other kids in the community. And I would gather the kids in her living room and preach to them. And she always got a kick out of that. You know, he was preaching the sermon that our preacher shared with us at church yesterday. And she would sing some songs. I'd call on her like she was in the choir, and she would sing songs, and all the little kids would sit there and listen to the message. And so, you know, I, I, I had a, I knew about church. I grew, like I said, grew up in it. But 15 is kind of where I credit that conversion experience in my life.
Now, buddy, you won't believe this. I don't want to make a big confession, but you know how I was traumatized by the story of a chicken when I was growing up, the chicken that pecked a cousin in the face because he went for the chick. So I don't want anything to do with chickens other than eating them. I don't want to hold them or anything. But I would actually, as a kid, would go and pretend I was a preacher to the chickens. I would stand there at a good safe distance, and I'd pretend I was preaching.
Well, you would have not liked my grandmother's house on my mom's side because she had a rooster that would chase us every time we went in the yard. Yeah,
no, nothing to do with unless it's a Gamecock, a South Carolina Gamecock, which is the football team, which is not that good, really. But okay, 15 years old. You went to church all the time, though, right? Three times a week?
Yeah, pretty much every time the door was open.
But you never really felt that pull of the Lord till you were 15?
Well, I mean, I always had, I guess, a desire from a young age, but I just never really, like, I feel like that's the point that I committed, you know, my life to where I wanted to live differently, do things differently. It kind of clicked at that moment, I guess.
Okay, what was it? We were at church?
Yeah, we were having... I don't remember if it was a revival or what, but I just remember there was some praying going on, and I started playing guitar when I was 15, so I was playing at church, and I don't know, just kind of, I had this little experience. I got all excited on the inside, and I just remember standing there on the stage and just kind of praying, you know, for God.
So, no, wait a minute. You didn't miss a beat when you're conversing. You just kept playing.
No, I just kept. I mean, I was playing.
You didn't kneel. You didn't say.
No,
you said, kind of nodded your head, yes, Lord, and kept going.
You know, just like God come into my heart, and just I was in the middle of a song that I had to keep going. So,
do you remember what song it was?
I have no idea.
And I have sitting beside me my friend, my cohort, my band member, one of the smartest guys I know, wonderful guitar player, wonderful singer, and an incredibly wonderful sound technician, Mr. Brian Hoogenboom. Hello, Brian.
Hello, Lawrence.
I like your name because I think it sounds like something out of a novel, like you're either the hero or the villain, but it's a great name, Hoogenboom.
I tell people it's like tripping and falling down the stairs, but I like your way better.
Hoogenboom is a, you told me, a Dutch name?
Dutch, that's right.
A Dutch name.
Mm-hmm.
So, Brian, we're going to do something a little bit different tonight. I've never done this on the podcast before, but we're going to play a sermon that I gave 3 weeks ago at my church here in Florence. 3 weeks ago, I preached a sermon, got in a camper van, and stopped by and saw Elton John in concert in Charlotte, then went to Austin, Texas, and Wichita with my wife and two dogs. We had a great trip, and I just got back yesterday. So this is the sermon that I preached before I headed out west. But I want to talk about you first. I'm going to pick three songs that you play on. And the first song I want to do is a song you wrote to your wife. And we've played it, I think, three times. But I love this song. So I know you talked about it before, but tell me about this song. It's called Oldsmobile. For all you young people, that was the name of a car back.
It used to be a General Motors vehicle.
Yes, it did.
Now it's an icon. My mother, when my wife and I started dating in 1984, we were teenagers at that time, 14, 15, somewhere around there. And, of course, I didn't have my own vehicle, but my mother had an Oldsmobile. And so it just kind of came up for the longest time. I didn't have my driver's license when we first started dating. So her parents would take us on dates.
Her parents?
Her parents would take us on dates. We'd go to the movies, they'd sit in the front, we'd sit at the back. And then we'd meet on the way out. It was great. It was great. But then as, you know, finally, a little bit later on, I got my driver's license. My mother would let me borrow the Oldsmobile. And we'd go out and always with friends. It was never just rarely just the two of us. It was usually just going to meet a bunch of our friends who embarrassed us very badly in different places in public. That's where some of the conversation about eating some pizza with friends is a line in the song. Just about some of that. Something else interesting about one of the lyrics in the song that I was probably more deliberate about putting in there was a kiss on the cheek.
I remember that.
Yeah, there was a kiss on the cheek.
Why wasn't it the lips?
No, it was a kiss on the cheek. It was actually my very first date with my wife. And we were at a teen center. Her parents had dropped her off. I had hitched a ride with somebody and gotten over there. But then we had a great time together at this little place. And then as we parted ways, her dad came to pick her up. And as I walked her to the car, before she got in the car, I reached over and kissed her on the cheek. And I have been told he did not like that. He was not impressed. And she was practically forbidden to see me again because I kissed her
on the cheek. Well, was this your first date?
Yeah.
This was the first date.
Date. I kissed her on the cheek.
What a fresh guy you were.
Yeah. And her father was not impressed. But I guess at some point maybe he needed his lawn mowed real bad or something like that, and he let me do it. And but somehow I worked myself back into his favor. And so
he gave her away with great joy.
He did. And as I was growing up, later teenage years after we started dating and all, he taught me so many things about repairing things and just about life in general and about being a man and those kind of things. I learned so much from just being around him.
Great.
He's always been a very generous man, very giving of his time and his skills to people in need and all that. And I just learned a lot from being around him. And so it's kind of a little bit of a joke about the kiss on the cheek, but also it's kind of a tribute to him, you know, because that was, you know, his whole persona was kind of wrapped up in that whole situation right there. And
it led to a marriage.
It did.
You've been married a long time and you've got a wonderful marriage, and it's obvious you two love each other. So that's why I like the song so much.
Oh, well, thank you.
Let's play it now.
All right. All right. Sounds good.
Just like a fire. times, a long way, just like a fine wine, keeps getting better with time. These are the best times today. Those are some good times, those were some fine times.
That was a song called Oldsmobile, written and performed by my good buddy sitting beside me, Brian Hoogenboom.
Me and my 88 friends, I will see.